shall we get our guest on? He's a great journalist. He's an old friend of mine, speaking to me on programs like this since my days in Spain when I first met him. And he's been coming on my shows ever since. He's been a huge contributor, a very valued contributor to my programs. Former BBC journalist, of course, an expert on Bilderberg, but more besides. He's the presenter of the politics show on BCFM, which is a great show. And I know many of our listeners have known Tony a long time, and they listen to that programme religiously every week, and, well, they might do as well. I invited him on today to have a look at some of the bigger stories over the last few days, look ahead to what's happening or what might be happening in the coming week or weeks. So let's just welcome back to the show our friend Tony Gosling. Tony, welcome back.
Hi, Richie. Thank you for having me again.
That's great to have you on, mate. Thanks for coming on. Brexit is boring the absolute pants off of the country, I think. It's certainly...
Well, it's supposed to be wearing people down, basically. And the idea, I think, is to sort of drag all of the potentially clear stuff into the mire, into the mud, just to get everyone really, really fed up with it. In other words, you're promised something. That is to say, you vote for something, you're supposed to get it. You know, that is to leave the EU. And then slowly but surely, over the months, I mean, we're talking really about around about, I suppose, nearly 30 months altogether since the vote. You're slowly broken to you that, oh dear, this isn't going to work. Oh dear, that's not going to work. And I mean, to me, it's a form of psychological warfare, really, to just wear people down. And I think it's having that effect with a lot of people, but then there's others who are saying, well, actually, no, we're determined that this Brexit is going to go through whatever the political elite do.
Yeah, it's good, Tony, because I remember Lisbon and Nice in my country, those treaties. And you know, it's interesting because I worked in commercial radio for the Nice Treaty debate. I had to keep my opinions to myself, understandably, and I did, but I voted no to Nice. Or Lisbon. Do you know what, Tony? It's such a brain drain. I can't remember which one it was. But anyway, the thing was, when it was put back to the people again, and of course it happened in Ireland twice, it was inevitable that people who voted no to closer alignment with the European Union would just be fed up, Tony. And by the time the second vote came around, they were so just fed up with politics and listening to politicians that many of them didn't go out and vote again. Would that happen, do you think, if we had a second EU referendum of sorts in a few months' time? Do you think many of those who voted leave might just be so sick of it that they just wouldn't go out that day?
Well, that's totally possible, yeah. I mean, the idea is there's a sort of subconscious aspect to having a second referendum, and that is, well, folks, you got it wrong last time. The people who are in charge of your lives have decided, for whatever reason, that they're going to ask you again. A little bit like, maybe a teacher asking a pupil, you come up with an answer to a question they've given you, and then they ask you again. The idea is, you know, you haven't got it right, so we're going to ask you again. I think that's the sort of subtext, really. But, you know, that whole business in Ireland with the Lisbon Treaty, it's not the only time that's happened. It's actually happened quite a few times. I mean, if we go
Denmark
back
as well,
to,
right?
For example, the Danish, there was something, wasn't there, around about, I think it was 2005, called the European Constitution, that various countries allowed their people to vote on, including, by the way, the French. They had a vote on the European Constitution. I'm not sure whether Ireland did as well. And then they came back and they said, oh, no, well, we've just basically rebranded it with a different name. And by the way, we're not going to give you a chance as to whether you want to vote on this or not. The government is just going to sign the treaty and we're handing over our sovereignty anyway. So, you know, that's the sort of thing we've had, I'm afraid, from the Eurocrats over, you know, probably the last 20, 30 years, is when the people vote the wrong way, then there's just simply another discussion and another decision. There's a, you know, what I might do after I've spoken to you is just share a tweet with you, Richie, from Darren Grimes. He says the Maastricht Treaty in Denmark, it was 51.7 no vote, but then the political classes in Denmark signed it anyway. That was around about 93, I think. Then we had in, I think it's Belgium, the Nice Treaty, people voted no. quite a substantial 54% voted no, but then they had it anyway. The EU constitution, oh, no, that's Ireland, sorry. An EU constitution vote in France and in the Netherlands, both quite resounding no votes, but then the Lisbon Treaty came along and the government just signed them up anyway. And also, of course, in Greece, where there was the Euro bailout vote, they voted 61% no, we don't want this Euro bailout, but they got it anyway. So in a way, it's a way of just wearing down people's resistance to the fact that you are in an oligarchy. We might give you votes, but then the most likely thing that's going to happen is that vote will be overturned.
You're absolutely right, Tony. It was Nice when I was working for WLRFM in Ireland. It was the Nice Treaty. I was producing the flagship mid-morning current affairs programme there. That resulted in 53.9% or thereabouts, people saying no. That's a fairly substantial victory, that, compared to 46.1% of those who said yes. Now, the turnout was fairly miserable, actually, at the time. It was a turnout of about 35, 36%, if I remember. But we came back the following year and did it again. And it was the same then in 2008 with Lisbon. I've been asked to put it to you, Tony. I mean, there isn't anybody who's researched and studied the Bilderberg group and where it came from and why than you. What's the relationship between the establishment of the European Union, which I suppose most people who go and do high school or secondary school history will think that the European Union came into being primarily to make sure we didn't all kill one another on the continent again. I don't believe that. Of course, I don't think you do either. What's the relationship with Bilderberg and the establishment of the European Union? No better man than Tony Gosling. Go ahead, Tony.
Well, okay, so it was something called the European Movement, which was formulated back in the 1950s. And Jean Monnet was one of the main people involved in that. So you can look him up if you want to, you know, look into that. But the Bilderbergs started around about the same time, and they were essentially a more open organization. Even though the meetings are very secretive, they included a lot more people, in other words, people who would be Eurosceptics too, on their invitation list. And also the Bilderbergs have always been much more focused around military union, around NATO, and around what's known as the Atlantic Bridge. Now, the Atlantic Bridge, you can see it if you look on any, you know, you open your wallet in Ireland and look at any euro note, you'll see it on the back. There's the Atlantic Bridge. They've actually changed the design of the euro notes recently to make it a bit less obvious, but certainly the euro notes up until probably last year or so were pretty much universally, you can see it now still, it looks pretty much like that, where you've got the continent of Europe on the right-hand side and a bridge heading off across the Atlantic. So the idea is a United States of Europe, and actually a United States of Europe that's working in concert with the United States of America. And we've seen that so much in world policy, and the Bilderbergs coordinate this kind of thing. That is to say, you get US bad cop and the EU good cop. But actually, you know, under the surface, they're working very closely together. But, you know, you've also got to look, I think, at institutions like the Frankfurt-based European Central Bank. Frankfurt, of course, being the base for the Rothschild spiderweb, which started spreading out around Europe in around about 1800 to Vienna, Naples, Paris, London, where Mayor, I'm sure, Rothschild sent his sons out to establish these banks. Now, these banks focused on lending to governments and, as a result, have become very close to government. And some would say, with this massive debt, the government is in debt. Well, they are indebted financially, but also indebted morally to the banks. They have to do what the banks tell them. The banks say, well, you can do this and do that, and then we'll, you know, give you some decent terms, give the government decent terms on loans. But Bilderberg is essentially a military style. I mean, you look at the people who go there, they're from the NATO countries, and they are really looking for the corporate interests, basically the mafia of the euro dollar zone, that is to say the Europe and the United States, and really imposing that will on governments and military. So coordinating a military effort, for example, the overthrow of Yugoslavia, it's quite clear there were some key Bilderberg people who were involved in that. The invasion of Iraq, key Bilderberg people there too. So you've got an oligarchy which are the super rich. And let me just tell you as well, Richie, having met some of these Bilderbergers face to face, it's quite clear their personality is rather peculiar in that they have already decided how they're going to run our world. And the idea that we might come up with something which might question what they're going to do is not the sort of thing that they want to hear. And in fact, when I brought up Brexit in front of a couple of the key Bilderbergers, Jacob Wallenberg and James A. Johnson. Johnson is from Goldman Sachs, and he was the guy that funded both Hillary Clinton and Obama's election campaigns. He basically just started swearing at me to go away, not politely, not a nice man. And with Jacob Wallenberg, he just demanded that I get out of his face. Actually, I was a fair distance away from him. And he didn't want to answer any of the questions, neither of them did, that I put to them about what they thought of Brexit. Very simple question to powerful people, one the most powerful banker in Sweden, another one of the most powerful bankers in the United States, and neither of them wanted to talk about Brexit. So the fact of the matter is, they have already decided there will be no Brexit, and the fact that some people think that there will or there might is the last thing that they want to hear. And I would suggest to you, I mean, we've seen now, I mean, the power of the Bilderbergers is through the financial system. Quite clearly, they are where the financial system is at. Most of the money in the Western world, these guys control it. We're talking about the IMF, the major, sometimes from the central banks, but mostly from the biggest private banks. So we're talking about HSBC, Deutsche Bank, you know, the really big, powerful banks. And they have decided, Mario Draghi has decided, regular Bilderberg guy, he's the chairman of the European Central Bank, the guy that runs the euro. They've decided just on Friday that they're going to completely stop any QE. Now, the QE, they've also admitted, is the only thing over the last 2 years. This is printing money that they do. It's basically counterfeiting. The bank is just printing money on bits of paper that has got no, it's not backed by anything. It's just paper, and they have a right to print it, so they can, and they do. That QE stopping is the only thing that's been driving any growth in the eurozone over the last 2 years. They've just come out with this report. It's only the QE that's been driving growth. So what is the you heard it here first. I had a chat with the economist Steve Keane earlier on today, and his immediate comment was, well, it's going to crash the European stock markets. That's what they're planning to do in the spring, just to coincide with Brexit.
He's starting to see a bit. I've had Steve on a few times on this program. His eyes have begun to open a bit in the last couple of years, haven't they? He's starting to see what's really going on. I think I like Steve Keane.
I do a lot. I mean, yeah, I think he's always been pretty much open. I mean, the thing is, he's come from mainstream economics.
Yeah.
But he can see, and he's dealt with, some of the massive hypocrisy. And also, the nepotism and the fact that so many economics journalists are far too close to the people that they're writing about. And they know that if they write critically about Goldman Sachs, who, by the way, have just had a massive fine, I think it's over in Singapore today, for criminality. These really are the banksters, these guys. And so what he's been saying about those is that there really is they've come to the end of the line, effectively. That there is only one thing that these guys can do now that they've got everyone hooked on this heroin of quantitative easing and printing money, and that is to just press the nuclear button. In other words, to crash the whole lot. And there's nothing, they don't seem to be able to do anything to actually make things better, except if they were put in jail, they might, but they haven't been put in jail. And I think Steve is coming to realise this. I mean, he's always been, I think, quite close to that. It was also interesting, he was telling me that he thought that Mario Draghi and the rest of them were idiots, basically, that they didn't really know what they were doing. And I would suggest to you that is deliberate. They're pliable, and they're being controlled from elsewhere. So they're the sort of people you would think, my God, how did he become chairman of the European Central Bank? The answer is simple. It's because other people behind the scenes are really controlling things. And what they need is pliable stooges like Draghi just to do whatever is the next instruction that comes along on the piece of paper. And they'll do it. And they'll do it in front of the cameras as if it's their decision. But actually, a lot of these decisions are being simply made by eminence greases, people behind the scenes are manipulating events, a bit like the Wizard of Oz, you know, behind the curtain.
Expendable people like Draghi, it's a great way of describing that. Tony Gosling is our guest, folks, host of the Politics Show on BCFM. Links, of course, will be put on Twitter, but you know where Tony is. Anyway, you can follow him on Twitter. It's at Tony Gosling on Twitter. I want to ask you, you mentioned Darren Grimes. What a coincidence. I played some audio during my monologue segment. I played some audio. Darren was on Sky News today with Kay Burley. There was a number of so-called younger voters and younger activists on to talk about the possibility of a second referendum. I thought he did very well. He conducted himself very well. One of the things he said was, is that there's going to be a consequence, there's going to be social consequences for the reversal of Brexit. And he talked about polarisation, and he talked about how we'll see, on the left and on the right, we'll see populism rise, and it could become very dangerous. Now, I don't think, I like this chap, Darren Grimes, but I think he's just not been around as long as some of us have to understand that, you know, the establishment, if there is violence, and if there is unrest, it'll be what the establishment wants. Will there be unrest, do you think, Tony? In the event this is inevitably reversed, do you think we're going to see massive protests that could lead to the sort of civil unrest we saw a few years ago?
Or the sort of civil unrest we've seen in France, for example.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, it's quite feasible, but, you know, I think that they, yes, you're right, they do want this kind of thing to, this kind of conflict on the streets at the top level. This is what they, it gives them a sort of thrill to see this kind of chaos. And of course, the idea is, ultimately, is they want to have domestic chaos in the countries that they own and control. I say they, I'm talking about the oligarchy here, you know, the super rich, the bankers, the people who own the press, for example, are very much involved in all this, people who manipulate the political system, the heads of big business, these kinds of people. But the idea is that you create the chaos and then they come along, riding along on their, charger, you know, on their horse, and then they put their sword in the air and say, it's okay, I can help you out. I can sort this all out for you. It's the ordo ab chao, the Latin order from chaos. And that is also very closely related to good old Naomi Klein and her shock doctrine. The idea is shock the people enough, and then you can push through your unpopular plans. Now, that, of course, means also potentially police state, that sort of thing, clamping down on civil liberties. But I think maybe more importantly, it's the ultimate plan here, Richie, is the destruction of the nation state. The idea that elected governments have failed, of course, they've been deliberately undermined. It's not just that they've somehow failed. They've been, you know, undermined by the banksters, the, you know, the massive organizations that pay virtually no tax. You know, your massive Amazons, people like that of this world, of the world, the investment, people who invest in these tax dodging multinationals, transnational corporations, the big ones, people like Philip May, Theresa May's husband from Capital Group in Los Angeles, who are a major funder of, investor in people like Amazon, Starbucks, and Lockheed Martin, people that make money from war. These are the guys that almost are playing with us. I see it almost like a cat and a mouse, so they're seeing what can we do here. And the idea that you might get riots on the streets. Well, that could be difficult, you know, shop windows being smashed, isn't it terrible? But that can also be an opportunity.
Yeah.
They may see it as an opportunity to, for example, bring in a military government in France. You know, so we say, well, we can't actually do the things that the people want, which are perfectly reasonable. I imagine you've seen their list of 25 demands.
Fantastic. Yeah.
You know, what they've done there is they've done a brilliant job in creating one document which includes all the basic aspirations of ordinary people. And anyone that's involved in any kind of little campaign, whether it's a, you know, media freedom campaign, whether it's, you know, animal rights campaign, whether it's against the pharmaceutical industry type of campaign, anything at all, they'll find something for them in there. And it's what they've done is they've presented what you call a classic united front. So anybody who wants social justice can just, whatever it is their particular beef is, they can pick up that piece of paper and start waving it. In fact, put on the yellow jacket.
You know, I've been watching that in France. I've told my listeners that my partner was back in France a week and a half ago, and she spent a few hours in Paris getting connecting trains to the east of the country. And watching that with great interest, and looking at those demands, which you quite rightly said are fairly reasonable. But Tony, you and I have been around a long time. Can we trust that this Yellow Vest movement is absolutely genuine, can we?
Well, look, no, you can't. But I tell you what, it's very, very difficult to contradict what they're calling for in those, in that list of demands.
Yes.
You, what you'll find is the way the establishment works is they always try to control the opposition. But when the opposition consists of 150, 200,000 people, it's not so easy to control, Richie. If it's a handful of 40, 30 people, 20 people, even on a protest that you might see on the news, or maybe even three or four, like Pussy Riot or something like that.
Yeah.
You know, one of these small protests, you know, pop group they're supposed to be, even though the music's diabolical. They're easy to control. When you've got hundreds of thousands of people and you've got ideas that they're behind, which you can't just change, you can't just, well, they do ignore them, of course, on the news over here, but the people who are part of the protests aren't ignoring them, then it's very, very difficult to control. And I would suggest that although they may have started this as a we'll try and control this, I mean, the big test is going to be after Christmas, isn't it?
Yeah.
Because clearly the weekend in the run-up to Christmas, there's going to be less people out on the streets in France, less yellow jackets around, because they've got family stuff to do, and they need to be with their families over the holidays. The big test is going to be in the new year to see whether they come back on the streets again.
It's interesting. You and I have been speaking since about 2009, amazingly. And I think we've often talked about, you know, people getting it. You know, why don't more people get it? And very interesting segue here, Tony. We've talked about the Rothschild dynasty and its influence in Western democracies and what have you. But again, Caroline, my better half, going back to France, and occasionally, I mean, Caroline's very wide awake to a lot of what's going on. You know, she's not blinkered the way a lot of people are. But when she speaks to her family, Tony, you'll smile when you hear this. When she speaks to her family, who think that, well, Caroline's fella Richie, he's all right. We like him. He's good. He looks after Caroline. But he's a mad lunatic. He's a mad lunatic with his radio show. That's what they think in France. And Caroline will say to her mum, but Macron is a Rothschild man. He's a Rothschild plant in the Elysee Palace. And they'll just go, tut, 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 tut. That's just ridiculous. That's just silly talk, Caroline. People will never wake up, Tony, will they? You know,
if they do, bit by bit. And I think, look, the reason why they do is when this stuff really comes close to their doorstep. I mean, all the time people have got reasonably cozy, you know, quiet lives. You know, they're in their comfort zone. That's fine. As soon as this stuff starts to come to your doorstep, say, for example, in your workplace, when you start to be told, well, actually, I'm sorry, you're going to have to take a pay cut, or we're only going to be employing you 4 days a week from now on. All these sorts of things is where people realize, actually, the financial screws are on here. And, of course, this is what the oligarchy's up to at the moment, is they really are putting on the financial screws big time. So what with the massive increase in migration, I mean, I've got nothing whatsoever against the asylum seekers, against the refugees, this kind of thing, at all. But when you've got mass economic migration, deliberate, I mean, for example, the mafia just bringing everybody across the Mediterranean, for example, in order to depress wages, in order to put a big strain on housing. And actually, what I think they've done is they've created a deliberate crisis with all this mass migration. And that the whole purpose of that is to make a dent on people's disposable income. So, and it's also the idea, of course, is also to allow big business to employ people for far less than they did before. So they'll sack all the previous people, employ a whole load of, you know, cheap labour. And that, as I think, is one of the main reasons why we are where we are. It's because at the end of the day, the governments are powerless. Well, they could stop it, but they're controlled by the same special interests who want to see cheap labour. And so we really do need to wise up, I think, and get extremely, and we need to back our national governments. I'm not saying to be jingoistic, in a nationalistic, jingoistic way, but if we do not stick up for our own national governments, we're going to end up with 850 million people across the EU, all being controlled by a bunch of failed politicians and bureaucrats with no checks and balances. In other words, when someone like Macron starts running things, there'd be nothing we can do to remove them.
It's such basic stuff. You know, I did a Sunday View a couple of weeks back and I explained how the European Union works logistically, as if I was explaining it in a school. You know, without any hyperbole, without any of my personal opinion. and it should be obvious to people what it is. Tony Gosling is our guest. There's been a brilliant question from Sharon Hall. Sharon, how are you? Thanks for listening. Check out Tony at BCFM, The Politics Show. Links to those can be found on my Twitter page, on Tony's as well, on his Twitter account, I should say. Great question from Sharon. Richie, ask Tony if he thinks the terror attack, in inverted commas, in Strasbourg was an operation, a false flag thing to discourage the yellow vest protests. That's not a bad question. What do you think, Tony? Good question,
well, it's these days it's the question we should always ask as soon as one of these terrorist attacks takes place. You know, what are the things I do, and I know, thank God, there are hundreds of thousands of people that do the same nowadays, is they get straight on the case. Let's have a look at this guy. Who was he? And let's have a look at the circumstances surrounding this. Does it look right? Or, and as soon as you start to get anomalies, 2, 3, 4, 5 anomalies all accruing, then you can be pretty sure that it's a put-up job of some sort. Now, this guy's shot dead, first of all. That means there'll be no trial. That means that the police officers that killed him won't go on trial. That means that there won't be any court proceedings to do with the people that died. There may be inquests, but no questions asked about him. The other thing, very importantly, it means is that all the newspapers, actually around about 50, I did a check on this on Friday, and around about 50% of the international newspapers were calling him the killer, conclusively, in their headlines and in their stories. The other half, funnily enough, mostly the US, ABC, NBC, CNN, these people, were calling him the suspect.
Yeah.
So, you know, immediately what's happened, he's gone from being the suspect to now he's dead, he's the killer, because legally, he can sue his lawyers can sue the newspapers if they call him the killer before a trial, but
correct,
as soon as he's dead, that means they can call him the killer, the murderer, the terrorist, whatever it is they want to call him immediately, and most of the European media have gone immediately over to calling him the killer. So that also helps to, shall we say, spin the coverage, so that, you know, we're being told this guy did it without any kind of question. And the other thing is that he had no history of any kind of Islamist involvement at all.
No.
In other words, he was a drug taker, he was a drinker, and he was, he was certainly not connected with any kind of terror groups.
They said he was radicalized in prison, T, didn't they? They said he was radicalized in prison. We can probably take that with a pinch of salt, right?
He also had his house raided that morning. So what was that all about? You know, very, very strange. And also, if this guy was so-called, you know, one of the people they were keeping an eye on, why was it? It's Sherif Shekat, by the way, is his name.
Yeah, that's right.
How did he get hold of guns? I mean, I would suggest the real scenario for this is France is having a trouble with all these riots going on and the yellow jackets. It's a very opportune time, immediately after Macron goes on TV and calls for calm. Perfect shock doctrine stuff through the media to have this attack taking place when it did, straight away after the Macron's call for calm. And ultimately, I think this particular attack, it's quite clear to me, this guy almost certainly didn't do it. And of course, there won't be any kind of checks on it because now he's dead. The people who did do the killings at the Christmas market might well be professional mercenaries, hired killers, people from private military companies who've been hired in specifically for that purpose. Then this guy is put out as the killer and hunted down and killed. I mean, I cannot remember what, for the life of me, what the name of the film was. But you know, when I saw this, that he'd been killed, this film flashed into my mind. I was sitting watching it, must be 4 or 5 years ago now. And it's a piece in the film, which was, when they showed it on the TV, it was in the film. I bought it on DVD and it had been taken out. And it's this poor guy, I think it was in related to Afghanistan or the Middle East somewhere, where there's a terror attack takes place on TV. And immediately, and we're sitting in this guy's living room with him and with his friends, and they're watching it, and they said, "We're looking for this guy. We believe he's the killer." And he's sitting in the room, and he's going, "What? I'm the killer?" And he stands up, and he says, "Well, yeah, but you've been with us all day, and we were out last night. What are they talking about?" And then, of course, suddenly he's a wanted man. He's being hunted down. And I imagine that that's what's happened to Sharif Shakat. The fact that he is a petty criminal, of some sort, a drug dealer, been involved in bank robberies, means that, you know, no one may miss him going. And he's probably got people, the people who are closest to him won't really notice, because he hasn't got a very strong social network around him, and he's just kind of disposable. That's the kind of thing I think that's going on now in the Western world almost all the time. And you know what, it started, I think this kind of thing started first in the 1980s with Operation Gladio, which you may have covered before, but secondly in the 1990s in Israel with the terrorist attacks just in Israel, just against Jews in Jerusalem and in Tel Aviv, just before Netanyahu got into power. The idea is basically kill our own people, and we throw our hands up in the air and we say, oh no, we're being killed. We need a strong leader. We need a strong leader. And that drives the population. It drives the political class. It drives through draconian police state legislation, drives everybody into the hands of the police state.
I want to say something to you there now. We, because of the nature of what we do, before I tell you this very quick story, go to thisweek.org.uk, thisweek.org.uk, folks, bilderberg.org, Tony Gosling is our guest. Tony, because of the nature of what it is that we do on a daily basis, we don't often get to hear daily independent radio shows, so I don't expect my guests to be listening to my program regularly, but I want to tell you something that you probably wouldn't have heard. When I was in Spain, we got to Spain in 2005-ish. We were there till late 2013. And my partner, who I've mentioned already, ran a terrific bar there in on the western Costa del Sol. Lovely place. She was great at it. It was fantastic. She had a few great years there. And we met a man. Now, you'll know some of this story. We met a man whose name I can't mention, but he was one of the mercenaries, one of the UK-trained mercenary soldiers who ended up being imprisoned in Angola in the late 1970s. They were on the wrong side. They were basically mercenaries fighting with South Africa, or a South African-based organisation called UNITA, which is trying to overthrow the Angolan government. You remember all this, Tony, right? And these guys were absolutely trained to the hilt, English soldiers, but they had nowhere to go. They didn't know wars to fight. So they took money, and they went to Angola. This is all in the news in the 80s, in the early 80s. One of them, or two of them, were executed by the Angolan government, and some of them were in jail for a few years, and they eventually were released, I think, in 1982, and sent back under an amnesty treaty, sent back to the UK. Why am I saying this? I've told my listeners this before. One of the men became very good friends with my partner Caroline and myself through him frequenting Caroline's bar. I know you're with me too. I want to make sure our listeners are with me. He got wind of the fact that I was very much interested in going beyond the headlines and looking at some of the, you know, conspiracy theories, as we'll call them just for the sake of it, and some of these things. And I've kept in touch with the guy for years, since we left Spain for years. And a couple of years ago, or more, another guy that was involved in that, who I got to know through guy number one, who was involved in Angola, said to me, you see that shooting in Paris at the Bataclan Theatre? And I said, yeah. This is privately now. They will not come on the air, these guys. He said, I've no doubt, Richie, that people like us, or people that we would have known and met along the road, mercenaries as you described them, Tony, I have no doubt, Richie, that someone took a contract to walk into the Bataclan Theatre. They were given a time period, basically told to kill as many people as they possibly can in that space of time. Now, the reason I told my listeners this story before, you probably won't have heard it, Tony. The reason I'm saying this again is because some people listening to this will think, I can't believe Alan left Gosling say that mercenaries might have opened fire in Strasbourg. I've had UK mercenaries who were in jail in Angola for fighting with Western-backed or South African-backed and American-backed rebels to try and overthrow the Angolan government. These guys were the real deal. And one of them told me that killing people in false flag operations is a regular enough thing, and it's been going on for years. Tony, over to you.
Well, yes, what about the 2014 coup in Ukraine?
Yeah.
We've actually had Georgian snipers going on the record. You can look at them on YouTube saying that they were taken over there. They were promised, I think it was $10,000 in order to kill demonstrators and police from the Hotel Ukraine. So they were stuck in, there was a guy managing the whole operation. I believe his name is Andriy Poruby, who later became the chairman of the National Security Committee of Ukraine under the Poroshenko government, the new government that came in after the coup, which, by the way, is just about, it's just about time expired. And beginning of next year, there's a presidential election in Ukraine, which Poroshenko is almost certain to lose. He's only around about 8% in the polls. And they've had this brilliant protest. I think actually the Yellow Jackets, and we could take some examples from them, where as the Ukrainian politicians, the MPs, come out of meetings, that there's a whole crowd waiting for them, and they pick them all up on their shoulders and then dump them into wheelie bins. So it's a fairly harmless thing to do, but it's extremely symbolic, and they get a great kick out of filming it and putting it on, you know, the TV, so people can see what they think of their politicians in Ukraine, the new generation after this coup. But then also the Georgian snipers also said that there were other rooms near them where there were, for example, they mentioned that Latvian snipers had also been brought in to Ukraine to kill police, to kill demonstrators from the windows of the hotel. And of course, that is basically Poruby, who was a commander of the Maidan protest, killing his own protesters. Yeah? Killing the police.
Killing their own
and killing
protesters.
His own protesters in order to make it look as if the Ukrainian government of Yanukovych, the previous government, was getting tough with the protesters and had decided to shoot some protesters. So these guys, the only reason that the Georgian guys went on to TV, onto YouTube, was actually, I believe it was a Greek or French TV journalist, maybe Italian TV journalist that did the documentary. Never been shown, of course, in our part of the world, even though it's absolutely crucial geopolitical info that everyone needs to know, was that because they didn't get their full pay. Quite clearly, they hadn't actually shot and killed enough innocent people, enough police, and enough demonstrators in order to merit the full pay that they'd been promised. So they said, right, well, we're going to go on camera and tell the truth about what happened. There was actually a court case in Ukraine where these guys went on a live video link into the court. So the people they were trying to prosecute in Ukraine for the killings were exonerated because they were actually, look, these guys have confessed and said that they did it. So this stuff certainly does go on. The only thing is, I think the real failing is that the mainstream press just tiptoes around it. It doesn't want to touch this stuff with a barge pole for whatever reason, because it's got a totally opposite agenda, which is that the Russians are the bad guys, that they go around poisoning everybody. And so what we've seen is a massive politicisation of the mass media, really has become the spearhead of the war machine, Richie.
Hey, Tony, shall we finish on that note? Thanks for coming back today, by the way. Shall we finish on the Russia note? Did you laugh yourself stupid this morning to see reports that the UK is reporting through the Foreign Office and through its counterparts in the Latvian government that the Russians are waging a propaganda war against the UK? I mean,
well, you know, one of the funniest things, and I really did laugh out loud when I saw that,
yeah,
was that the Russians are behind the Yellow Jackets protests in Paris.
That's right. And did you see this today? RT ran a very good story. I was going to come to this a bit later on, but apparently BBC producers, and no better man to talk about working for the BBC than you, they've been under extraordinary pressure to try and link Russia to the Yellow Vest protesters. Editors at the BBC have come clean. They've said, we're being told to find the link.
Well, the other massive story is the one uncovered by, I believe it was a UK column and printed in the Sunday Record, which is the Scottish paper, or the Daily Record, which is that this troll farm was being funded up in Scotland in an old derelict-looking mill with ex-military intelligence officers, psychological warfare officers, who were being paid a vast amount of money, much more than they would be if they were still working for the military. They were running a troll farm up in Scotland, which was trolling Jeremy Corbyn. Now, they were being paid to try and counter Russian propaganda, but they clearly couldn't find any Russian propaganda to counter, and so they were spending our taxpayers' money on dissing Jeremy Corbyn, actually writing lies about Corbyn and lies about the Labour Party, and that's government money that was being spent.
Government money, that's right. Of course, it made the
unbelievable, really. And I would actually, if I were Corbyn and the rest of the team, I think they should really be making a big thing of this, possibly a court case too against the company.
But they won't, of course. And you and I could have a whole other discussion on who Jeremy Corbyn really is. And we could, and I have his brother Piers on this programme regularly enough. Piers knows what I think. Not of him personally, because I don't know him personally at all, but on his absolute abject failure to take on the British press over the anti-Semitic bollocks, excuse my language, and everything
well,
else.
Well, I think he's decided, for right or wrong, remember he's being advised by Seamus Milne, and I think he's decided that he is going to tough it out with the press, and that potentially, I mean, maybe he's right. I think he's really, really put, he's basically lost the plot with Brexit, because he and his party are pretty much going along with the Remain, even though the vote was in the opposite direction. So that hasn't, I mean, he's really sunk in the opinion polls, gone down something like 7-8% just over the last few weeks in the opinion polls because of his party's attitude to Brexit. But I don't think he's a bad guy particularly. I think he's actually much more of an ordinary person who's just basically saying, well, look, there's nothing I can do to remove Rupert Murdoch and to change these people. And I actually, and he actually does believe in freedom of speech. So he's saying, well, I'll tell you what, I'm going to tough this out because I think the British public are not going to be fooled by all that propaganda, and I just want the party to at least have a reasonable chance. And you know what? They haven't had a debate, have they? They really should have had a debate, Corbyn and May, under any, whatever circumstances in the run-up to this whole Brexit business right now. I mean, they should have had something. Back in the when we went into the EEC, the Labour leader, Michael Foot, and Edward Heath had a discussion. There were loads of discussions. Roy Jenkins and Tony Benn within the Labour Party having live TV debates. We've had none of this. All we get is panels of journalists and selected audience, selected panels like the BBC Question Time panel, which is usually mostly Remainers, like, you know, three quarters of Remainers on the panel. So the whole thing is being stage managed. I want to see Corbyn up against Blair. I want to see someone from the DUP, maybe. Corbyn against May.
Yeah.
Someone from the DUP up against May. You know, let's have a bit of proper journalism. There's virtually none of it.
But you know, I'm going to argue with you. It's about time we found something to disagree on. What difference does it make if Corbyn goes up against Theresa May? Corbyn was a lifelong... Socialism is incompatible with membership of the European Union. He's a lifelong Eurosceptic. But now, of course, he's... And only 2 weeks ago, he told Sky News, Faisal Islam, that delaying Article 50 might not be the worst thing. He's open out to a second referendum. Come on, Tony, he's a wet blanket. He's a waste of space, Corbyn. I'm surprised at you, Mr. Cosley.
But he's the elected leader, so, you know, same as... Well, Theresa May is not, actually. She has never been... I mean, the thing is, you've just got to allow the Labour Party membership to elect whoever they want to elect. And that's the end of the story. If they elect someone who's good, fine. If they elect someone who's bad, fine.
Yeah, I agree with you. It's just that I don't care, Tony. It's just that I just don't... I don't care. Yes, but I don't care because it's never going to change. It doesn't matter. If Mother Theresa was reincarnated and put in charge of the Labour Party, doesn't matter. This system, we're never going to change our lives and our paradigm through the ballot box. Doesn't matter who is running Labour, it doesn't matter. And you know better than most people that is true. Absolute final word to you. I won't interrupt you, and I won't come back with a comeback. Final word, and by the way, before you give us the final word, sincere, warmest thanks for the time that you give us on this programme. I bring you on a dozen times a year. We've been doing it for years, and you always come on. You're always astute, well-briefed. You've got brilliant arguments to make. We love having you on. So Merry Christmas to yours and everybody.
I wouldn't do it if I didn't think it was time well spent.
Yeah, well, cheers. We love having you on.
Look,
final word, go ahead.
Box, we must focus on the ballot box. One of the reasons that it isn't so important anymore is Brussels. Brussels controls much of our policy, certainly all of our agricultural, fishery policy, trade policy. Much of our financial policy is controlled through Brussels. So you can't change anything through the ballot box with regard to those policies. They are all decided by unelected bureaucrats and failed politicians in Brussels. That's why so many people came out as part of the referendum. Something like 25-30%, 35 in some area, percent more than would turn out for a general election to vote leave in the EU referendum. Yeah. Whether we actually get a chance to leave, well, it's down to the political class to sort that one out. But it seems to me if they don't sort it out, if we don't leave, quite possibly, quite simple thing, leaving means going out potentially on World Trade Organization, that is to say what they say a no-deal Brexit, but that is leaving. That's what we voted for, by one means or another. We're not staying in. And one thing they certainly shouldn't be allowed to do, the Brussels, is to split up the United Kingdom and Northern Ireland as a way of saying, well, you can have your Brexit, but as one way of, if we split up Northern Ireland from the rest of the UK. Now, I actually believe ultimately a United Ireland would be a good thing, but this is just doing it by the back door, and it's really upsetting a lot of people in the North. And we need to do that through a democratic means. It's amazing, isn't it, as well, since January last year, there's been no Stormont. Isn't that funny?
That's right.
Now there's been no proper discussion for the Northern Irish about all of this, even though Northern Ireland seems to be at the centre of the problems around Brexit. No Stormont. I think that that was a setup, and they didn't want there to be discussion, and they didn't want there to be the views of ordinary Irish people through Sinn Féin, through the DUP there, etc., and the other parties to be expressed. And ultimately, I think if they do try and block Brexit, it's not as if the likes of Farage and the DUP and the rest of the Leave campaigners are going to go away. They're certainly not. The UK Independence Party has been sabotaged quite clearly Tommy Robinson being implanted and basically infiltrating it successfully with help from Gerald Batten. But that doesn't mean to say, I mean, UKIP is just a name. There's a fantastic number of, you know, very well committed people who are saying, look, we don't believe in the end of the nation state. We don't believe failed politicians should be controlling the lives of 850 million Europeans.
Brilliant, mate. That was the final word. Merry Christmas, Tony. Thisweek.org.uk. Check out the politics show. And Happy New Year. And we'll speak again with your permission in January. Speak soon.
God bless. Thanks a lot, Richie.
You're welcome, mate. Brilliant stuff. Tony Gosling, top man. The politics show, unmissable. Thisweek.org.uk. Check out Bilderberg.org as well. Great to have Tony on the show. A little musical interlude. When I come back, I'll be reading your tweets. There's been plenty of them. This is the Richie Allen Show.